This is the people that you're seeing here is the Portfolio Committee for Health in the National Assembly. It's an extension of the Parliament. We are doing work on health issues in what we're trying to do, in trying to make all the citizens of South Africa and those that are in South Africa trying to make them healthy. That is our target. And as Parliament, we are oversighting what our department is trying to do in making people healthy. And at the same time, we try and look at the laws that need to be made such that we make our people and those that are in South Africa healthy. And at the same time, we make our communities understand what the government is trying to do in looking at health issues. Now, we have thought the Council for Medical Aid is one of those people that are helping us to achieve that. So we decided to call you so that we can hear what you are doing. And obviously, when we call you and you tell us what you are doing, we are going to be interested in asking a lot of other questions because we don't know everything that you are doing. And some of things are going to be new to us, so we are going to be engaging you with a lot of questions. And after that, for today, we will ask you to leave us. We're still going to continue with another business here as members of Parliament. But we are going to be calling later on the actual medical aid team to come and talk to us. But we wanted to do that after we've talked to you as the Council for Medical Aid. So that is going to be the program. As you, I'm sure you've been given the agenda for today. And we're going to try and make it very short because by 12:30 we should be finished here. And there are other things that we need to discuss outside in Panama. So as you can see the program, we're going to be having remarks. I've already made those remarks. And you're going to present to us as to what you're all about. And then we'll discuss that. And only after that, that you can leave us. So let me welcome everybody who's here. I'm told that there are journalists. Welcome you journalists that are here. We are going to tell you who is here from the Portfolio Committee side. Myself, I'm Vincent Kolkwane, the chair of this portfolio. On this side, let me start on this side. He's sitting with the opposition. This is the opposition that Hanaro is sitting. It's Hanari is a member of the portfolio committee, but unfortunately, he's got no seat on this side. He has not crossed the floor, but he's still on this side. On this side, we've got Umekere, the lady that is respected. Beyond her is the whip of the committee, Mrs. Chwete. Beyond Mrs. Chwete is Dr. Silva Pile. All these are members of the committee. Beyond Dr. Pile is Dr. Lutuli. She's Albert Lutuli, by the way. She's got a male name and the name of Albert. She's Albert Lutuli. Somebody is surprised outside Manchu. That you are Albert Lutuli. She is Albert Lutuli.
Yeah, and
he keeps that to beyond the lady who was saying she's frustrated because she has lost her cell phone, it's Mamu Kenya. She's a member of the committee. Beyond Mamu Kenya, we've got Mike Waters that side. He's smiling. You can see people this side are very kind hearted. You can see Mike is smiling, so beyond him is Mr. Hussein. You can see even Hussein is smiling, so we are going to have it very good. We've got people who are officials. Is your seat,
No.
The lady was just coming, another member, Mamu Train. She's going to sit on the opposition side. we've got next to me, I've got two secretary for the committee of yoga at the Matalamba. On this side, I've got two Joy, and we've got two kids sitting there. Oh, and Lisa, and we've got two sisters. Those are the people that are helping us to do the work that we're doing. So maybe before we go on, before you go on with your presentation, we need to know who we're going to be talking to. I know you're going to forget all the things that I've mentioned, but if we move on, you learn who is there and who's not here. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Patrick Matthews. I'm the acting registrar of the Council for Mental Peace, and I'm with my colleagues.
I'm Dan Lehuja, I'm the Chief Financial Officer of the Council for Mental Peace.
Lehuja. Oh, not Lehuja. Are those the only two members?
Yes.
Oh, who are the other people there?
My name is Humphrey Zokufa. I'm the Managing Director for the Board of Trustees of Finance.
There's still some people that I don't know, that we don't know.
I'm Patrick Sal. I'm the new member on the board of the ANC.
Oh, Zende Mohammed. I should have
been
let's apologize. There's some changes that have happened. So now we've got new members that have just joined us. She's very new, she's new from the board. Okay. There's another new member. Can you introduce yourself where you are? This is the young one. Please don't let me be here.
Oh, yes.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Shelly Lucizo Makubela Mashele, and I'm from Mpumalanga, and I'm the vibrant youth voice in this community of nearly old people.
No, don't worry, we're going to make sure that our hair is not gray and our baldness. We're going to put on wigs. Can you know the other people that are sitting here? I know kids, because just kids. The other people?
I'm Sophia, I'm from the
government.
Mike from the healthcare monitor.
Mike? You know there's another mic here. Thank you. Can we give over to you to make a presentation? Is it not working?
Council of Medical Skills is very poor. Yeah, well, let me find out.
My apologies for...
No, it's counting downwards, so we take it that when it reaches zero. you would start looking at that one. While we are waiting for the computer, is it not hot yet? Don't we need to switch off this? I'm asking the new member.
Fine,
it's fine. Oh, okay.
We switch it off if it gets warmer.
No, no, we put it on negative. No. Put it on minus something.
It will be freezing. Okay, let's leave it.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to all the committee members and my colleagues in the industry. After vetting with the three bodies presenting from the main body, my presentation will be focusing largely on operational activities of Council as well as our budget. However, as indicated earlier, we will obviously interact with yourself.
Sorry, can we have one meeting? Can we give him a chance? Okay, continue.
As I was saying, we will be at liberty to interact with yourself on any of the other issues pertaining to the industry. Just by way of outline, I thought it would be important to highlight the legislative mandate of the Council for Municipal Schemes, just to give context and to place it within the broader legislative ambit in the health environment. Following that, I'll look at the accountability structure to see how our reporting structure fits in the broader scheme of things, composition of the Council, Office of Organograms. A bit of overview of the industry, which has been a topical issue of late, and conclude with our operational activities, how we see things going forward, and what areas of focus we will be putting our efforts on. We are obviously mindful of the recent legislative proposals. We are acutely aware of what the initial proposals are, and it is something we have factored in our process.
Sorry, just a minute.
I'm a bit worried. We need to organize sitting first so that we're all, you know, the parliament are not supposed to be sitting at the desk. They're supposed to be sitting
Sorry about that, sir. I'm sorry about that.
Are we all settled? Sorry about that, you can continue.
That is an outline of my presentation. Just by way of mandate, the council is a statutory body that are set up taking into account the Medical Schemes Act. It commenced its activities in 2000. So it's been in existence for just under 10 years now. The primary objectives really were broadly to protect the interests of the beneficiaries. Obviously, there are other provisions in the ECA legislation, but the key one that I thought would be relevant in this case is the protection of the interests of beneficiaries. How we do that is through the promotion of non-discriminatory access to privately funded health care. It espouses open enrollment, which says everyone can join a medical scheme without any undue barriers. And there is a criteria for that, but you're free to join a medical scheme, particularly open medical scheme. The second issue is community rating, where things like an individual's contribution should be based on income or number of dependents, or both income and number of dependents. And the third one is guaranteed benefits. This is a set of guaranteed minimum benefits, which is known as prescribed minimum benefits in the environment. And it constitutes of more than 270 disease treatment pairs, which are arranged by organ systems, followed by 26 chronic conditions, typically your diabetes, asthma, etc., and lastly, emergency medical cover. And that is one issue that I need to spell out a bit more to say. Theoretically, a medical scheme is only obliged to provide guaranteed benefits by law. However, we have seen instances where medical schemes will provide what we call non-PMB benefits. And those we regulate through Section 24, which ensures that they are not discriminatory as they are being provided by medical scheme. But we also ensure that whatever additional benefits are added are commensurate with the contributions that the member will ultimately be charged. There is a process underway to relook at this provision due to some of the inadequacies that have been raised both in the media but also through some of the staff, and I'll get back to that later on. The other responsibility is to promote financial stability and sustainability. There is a requirement in law that a medical scheme should, at the very least, maintain a solvency level of 25%. They are free to go beyond that, but that is the minimum. In addition to that, all options within all medical schemes should be self-sustainable, meaning they should be able to stand on their own. And there have been some challenges in the medical schemes environment with regard to that, but it's a process that we are monitoring on an ongoing basis. The Act also encourages active participation of members in scheme affairs, and that is done in two ways at least. One is that as a member of a medical scheme, you are allowed to participate in the governing structure of that of your medical scheme. You can be a board member of your medical scheme. But also, we require medical schemes to hold annual general meetings in order to give feedback to their members who are the major shareholders
of that scheme on a regular basis. And again, that is a process we monitor on an ongoing basis. And lastly, we are obliged to investigate all the complaints that are submitted to the council by all the stakeholders and resolve them to the satisfaction of the parties concerned. If there are any points for clarification, please don't hesitate to ask. I just want to emphasize that the medical scheme act is but one of the legislative provisions that are intended to do that which I've already articulated, because we operate primarily on the funding side, but there's a host of legislative provisions that guide or regulate the provider or the delivery side, and these are just some of them. In terms of functions, it's a bit of a busy slide. The council's primary responsibility is to protect the interests of beneficiaries at all times, to coordinate, control and coordinate the functioning of medical schemes in a manner that is complementary with national health policy, to make recommendations to the minister on the criteria for the measurement of quality and outcomes of the relevant health services provided for by medical schemes and such other services as the council may from time to time determine, to investigate complaints and settle disputes in relation to the affairs of medical schemes provided for in this act, to collect and disseminate information about private health care. We do this through the publication of our annual report and any other reports that we disseminate from time to time, to make rules not inconsistent with provisions of this act for the purpose of the performance of its functions and the exercise of its powers, to advise the minister on any matter concerning medical schemes, and lastly, to perform any other functions conferred on the council by the minister or by this act, and this we do from time to time. That's our vision, which I won't belabor you with, is in the printout, and this is just a summary of our strategic objectives, which again I won't belabor you with. In terms of accountability structure, we obviously are accountable to the Minister of Health. We interact a lot with the ministry. We've got a council which oversees our activities, which is a top member council. And then we've got the acting CEO. So this is after the resignation early this year of our CEO. There is a process underway to appoint a full-time CEO, given some of the legal challenges that we face, but also the lack of provision in our legislation for something called an acting CEO. Our chairperson is Professor William Peake, and the deputy is Ms. Tracy Fortune. And there is a spectrum of expertise in the council, which covers representatives from the department, actuaries, lawyers, consumer representatives, and medical practitioners. By way of subcommittees, we've got an ESCO, a council. There's an appeals committee. This committee serves to entertain all the complaints where the aggrieved party is not happy with the ruling of the office. They escalate to the appeals committee. And when all else fails, they can escalate to the appeals board. So in a way, it constitutes a quasi-judicial process. And then we've got human resources as well as the audit committee. The font is very small, but this is the structure of the office of the registrar. We've got, once again, the IT as the accounting officer, the communications unit, financial supervision, which oversees the financial situation in medical schemes. They are the ones who will be ensuring that the schemes are sustainable, the solvency, okay, the income statement, balance sheet, etc., are up to scratch. We've got research and monitoring unit, which does research from time to time, compliance and education and training, where enforcement takes place, but at the same time, there is a responsibility to educate and train both trustees as well as consumers. Legal services to mind the legal side of business, complaints adjudication, accreditation, the accredited managed care organizations, administrators,
as well as brokers. Benefits management, this is the unit. It's a new unit that is responsible for adjudication of proposed contributions and benefits of all medical schemes. And then we've got support structures such as IT, human resource, and internal finance. On the extreme right-hand side, we've got a project called Risk Equalization. And this project has to be seen within the context of what was earlier submitted as amendments to the Medical Schemes Act, which we have been advised is being looked at against the new policy development. So we will need to look at it in that context. It is a delegated responsibility from the Department of Health. Just a brief overview of the industry we regulate. We've got 119 not-for-profit registered medical schemes. Of this, we have 37 open medical schemes, two of which are represented here. You heard about Discovery Health, it's an open scheme, and Prosana Medical Scheme, also an open medical scheme. There are a few others. We have 82 restricted schemes. This will range from employer-based schemes like IBM to professional medical schemes such as PAMA and union-based medical schemes such as Food Workers Union. But in addition to this, I need to flag the fact that we've got close on 40-odd medical schemes that are classified as bargaining counsel. In terms of the medical schemes, those are legit medical schemes, but due to circumstances, there is a joint regulatory arrangement with the Department of Labor to implement and bring those that can afford to into the system. The reason we haven't done that in one shift is in recognition of the fact that some of them won't be able to provide all the benefits that a normal medical scheme currently provides. We've got seasonal bargaining counsels, some operate in the wine industry, farming industry. So I just wanted to flag that those provide a good service, even though it's not at the same level as that of medical schemes, but for reasons of affordability, has been left out. In addition to that, you've got a few entities that operate in the for-profit environment. By the way, medical schemes are trust and they are not-for-profit. We currently, or as of December 2008, we had 23 administration companies. These companies administer on a third-party basis medical schemes, but there are a few that are self-administered. We had 7,755 brokers, probably slightly more than the GPs that we have in the investment. We had 2,081 brokerage companies and 55 managed care companies. Again, we had a total number of 7.8 million covered lives. This has been largely as a result of the growth of the government medical scheme, employees medical scheme GEM, but also the transfer of two bargaining councils, Automate and NIMED, which came together to form what is now called Motor Health, with a total membership of 150,000 members, beneficiaries, so to speak. The total gross contribution income last year, December, was 74 billion, and the annual gross claims incurred was 64.7 billion. This just indicates the trend that we observe in terms of how, or the proportion of benefits that medical schemes pay for on behalf of the beneficiaries. And as you can see, at the top end, we've got 23 billion that went to hospitals. It's not a small amount by any stretch of the imagination. Second, we've got medical specialists who enjoyed, in terms of proportion, 21.7%. The hospitals took about 37.7% of the total expenditure. Following on that, we've got medical expenditure, which around 2004 seemed to have been impacted upon somewhat courtesy of the legislative provisions that the government brought about, which appears to have had a positive impact, but we are beginning to see an increase, and that could be explained by a number of factors. There are new technologies that have come across, biologicals are now being provided by most medical teams. There's still a high degree of utilization of ethical drugs, even though we have seen an improvement of generics, but it's not yet at the level at which we would have liked, and at the level at which it would have had a bearing that would impact positively. And following on that, we've got GPs and the rest other providers. Just quickly on the financial soundness of medical fees, we are beginning to see medical schemes facing challenges. The operating results seem to be going down, and some have got solvency that leaves much to be desired. And the effect of that has been an increasing level of amalgamation as well as liquidation. However, on the whole, medical schemes have got a solvency of around 36.6%, which is way above the prescribed level of 25%. Again, very quickly, we do entertain concerns, and it remains concerning for the council to find that out of 3,000 complaints that were registered with us last year, about 1,166 related to unpaid accounts. And this is as a result of various sectors. We are following on this. We continue to do that. We engage with medical teams. We try to understand what the problem is. But it remains a serious concern that we've got 37.2% of all the complaints submitted to council being due to unpaid accounts. And we have seen, though, a decrease in the number of complaints pertaining to limitations on benefits, stroke, P&B, formularies, and DSPs, but there are still challenges in that as well. In terms of our operational activities, I've decided to split them into two. We have been working on the basis of the medical amendment bill, and largely along two lines. The first one was substantive policy changes, which we accept has been overtaken by events. The second one had to do with technical changes that we got to be effected in the Medical Schemes Act. Those technical changes primarily would have impacted positively on a recent judgment, which is commonly known as the Garst-Rutledge judgment. The effect of that judgment has been that we are now beginning to see an increasing number of Me Too products, but also products that does the business of a medical scheme. And that begins to encroach and impact negatively on the current environment as it is.
Again, those products, Me Too, what
does it mean? I call them Me Too. They are gap cover products, but there are also medical scheme tax products that are operating under the insurance environment. Some of you will probably know products such as GetMed. That is the product that's operating at the low end of the market, but it is doing the business of a medical scheme. We are approaching that in two ways, which is what I've highlighted. Firstly, we are trying to improve compliance where we pick it up and where the legislation allows us to do that. Secondly, there's a process set up by Treasury to try to delineate products that fit with the definition of insurance, but also to separate them out from those that are doing the business of medical schemes. So we hope that those processes will proceed to the benefit of those members who might falsely believe they are joining a medical scheme by joining these products, only to find that they will be shortchanged over time. The second process is the PMB review process. This process commenced early last year, and the view was to look at the current PMB provisions and try to plug gaps, particularly where they exist. And it has also been looking at instances where essential care might not be sufficiently catered for within the PMB package. Again, this is a process that will now have to be looked at against the broader process of the National Health Insurance. We have been informed by the Department of Health that there will be a pronouncement soon. We are anxiously waiting to understand how it will unfold and how we can participate going forward. I think the same can be said on the other project that we're waiting on, which is the Risk Equalization Fund. It was intended to help them the kind of what we are currently seeing as the pressure on medical teams, but due to policy developments, once again, we would need to look at it against the background of the National Health Insurance. The fourth project, which is more a research project, which does have policy implications, is to look at the current non-PMB package and try to understand what impact that has got on members. And this will obviously look at other aspects or tools that medical teams are using, such as your deductibles, such as your gaps, self-payment gaps, such as your co-payments. All those things will obviously have to be looked at to try to understand how they impact on members and where possible to develop appropriate interventions. The rest are the operations of the council, which includes the ongoing review and approval of contributions and benefits. And we are acutely aware of the concerns that have been raised by members. It is something that we've been looking at over time, but it is something that we will obviously have to tighten going forward. As I'm speaking, we're approaching October. That is the time when all medical schemes that change their benefits for the following year would be required to submit those proposals to us. And we obviously would have to put a magnifying glass on all those provisions to ensure that at the very least members are not unduly prejudiced. And the others are just your general operational activities, accreditation of administrators, training and education, ensure compliance with the provisions of legislation, etc. And number seven, I just want to flag that it's a project that was delegated again to the council by the Department of Health. It seeks to identify all PMB through ACD-10, and it is a process that we have managed so well up to now, but we are in discussion for it to obviously be transferred to the department where it will be better resourced and it can be better managed, and we've got issues around institutional strengthening. So in a nutshell, that covers the operational side of our activities, and then our chief financial officer will entertain the random plan of those activities.
Okay, thank you. You can go ahead while you are preparing yourself. I just want to remind members that we've got a register that we've got to sign as members. Unfortunately, it's a new thing. We've got to sign the time that you come in and the time that you walk out of the meeting. So it's a new thing. I saw it today. It's the first time that I'm seeing it, but we've got to do it. Okay, you can go on, CFO.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. In terms of our budget, we obviously are governed by the legislation, you all know, the Public Finance Management Act. We prepare this budget in terms of that particular guideline, Section 33, which requires us to prepare the budget at least 6 months before the beginning of the financial year. The Public Finance Management Act is an important act for us as a public entity. As you know, that we are also accountable to the minister. We are also being audited by the Auditor General because of that, in terms of the Public Audit Act. And in that regard, Chair, we are pleased to advise the portfolio committee that we've been receiving successive clean audits in financial years. We have never received any qualified audit opinion in that regard. Even in this financial year, in our annual report, you'll see we have received an unqualified audit opinion. I've just outlined that we are accountable to the executive authority, which is the Minister of Health, where we submit our budget for October. And having determined our operational objectives, as Patrick has outlined, we then set a levy. Our main source of funding is the levy on medical schemes, which for this financial year is set at about 16.42 per member per year. It's about an increase of 1.52 from the previous financial year. We had it at about 13.90. When we prepare this budget, we're taking into account our broader strategic objectives as outlined, and obviously we're taking into account the experience of the past financial year and our economic conditions as we know them. And we try to match our expenditure in terms of when we are going to achieve a particular objective in terms of our operational plan. So we've got an appeal, an appeal process, which is an appeal board. The appeal board is appointed by the minister, where most of our decisions are appealed, and we put the figure there. And so the figures are in the text that is given you. I'm not going to take you through the figures, but if you have questions, we'll be glad to answer those questions. The audit fees, as I've indicated, we are being audited by the Auditor General. This is the figure that we agree with the Auditor General in terms of their audit plan. Each year when they are going to audit us, they come to us and put an audit plan. And in that audit plan, they also put in a figure which we'll put into our budget as well. The internal audit fees, the Public Finance Management Act requires us to have an internal audit function, which may either be outsourced or be in-house. In this regard, we have outsourced that. It's an external auditing company which is doing our internal audit function. And we also, they are required in terms of the Act to submit a three-year rolling plan and how they are going to be undertaking the activities in that particular 3 years, but we call them in terms of each financial year. So we also are basing our internal audit fees in terms of the audit coverage plan that they would have submitted to us. Bank charges is your normal banking charges. I'm not going to take you through this, all these things, but I'll talk to, like, the consumer education, for example. Consumer education, this is an important aspect for us because most of our consumers, that members of the medical field, do not know what they are entitled to in terms of the benefits. So we have got about 3 staff members who go out to each and every corner of the country to talk to the consumers about the benefits that we have, they have under the Medical Skills Act. So that consumer education budget is intended to educate our consumers with regards to the work that we do as council in terms of protecting the interests of beneficiaries. Consultancy fees as well, I think in this current financial year, we put out the figure that the communication work will require in terms of assisting the editing of our documents so that we produce quality reports, our annual reports and our magazines, our quarterly magazines as well. And our IT is going to use this particular line item in order to revamp our call center and development of new financial terms. I think Patrick has indicated that our financial supervision units are monitoring the financial soundness of schemes. And in that regard, we're using an online return system where medical schemes submit their monthly accounts on or to us through this financial system. So it's a very, very important function of our IT unit to maintain us so that teams do provide us with accurate information for purposes of the analysis. Council committees, as members of council do come to our meetings, they must be taken care of in terms of travel and accommodation. We've indicated that we've got about 12 members of council who attend our council meetings, as committees and committee meetings. So we need to take care of them because they're traveling from Cape Town, Devon, and from whatever destination because they're right across the country. And the member's fees is the speaking allowances that we pay to council members as they sit in these various committees. The employee wellness program, in order to have a productive staff, the council has decided to put to sponsor staff in terms of health activities like the gym membership, the small subsidy, and you know, in a working environment, there are some stress sessions, so we do provide counseling to our staff members as well. So that counseling session is provided for in our employee wellness program. Employee benefits as well. Our employees are very important to us for the delivery of the service we are doing, and the employee benefit line item is intended to cover for such incidents as accidental death or disability. And HR organizational strategy, the issues of talent management, succession planning, we have undertaken in the previous year to do flexible term working conditions so that people are able to work on flexible time. So an HR organizational strategy, we are working on talent management, succession planning, and some other related HR important strategic objectives. Insurance, for example, we also are putting an insurance for our contents, office contents, as you know, that you need to have such things in place. And we always go out on tender to get such a service provider. Internet expenses, we also have a service level agreement with the service provider, which is called Internet Solutions. Investigations, in terms of the work we do, sometimes we are engaged in investigations of medical students. I think Patrick had alluded to the compliance and education division. That is the unit that does the investigation. And I think we are currently now busy with an investigation on the police. You must have seen that in the paper. So we also put an amount. And this is unpredictable because we do not know in each year how many investigations we will undertake given the dynamics of the industry as such. Likewise, with the legal fees, we always have challenges with regard to the decisions we take in terms of our regulatory mandate. We go to court, we go to appeal court, whatever the case might be. So we provide an amount to deal with legal matters in our budget. Media and promotion. Our communication division is responsible for the printing of our annual report. In terms of the legislation, we are expected to produce an annual report 5 months after the end of the financial year, which is now the end of August. We have to print an annual report. We also are producing quarterly publications, which we call the CMS News. That is intended to cover such costs, the media and promotion line item. We have just produced our annual report, which will be made public next week because the deadline is the 31st of August. The operational planning sessions, I think this is a very important activity for us. Each year, the beginning of each financial year, the entire office of our staff members, we go out and plan for the year ahead. So we plan for what we'll be doing for the financial year. So it is what all the members of staff in the office, about 8 or so, go out and plan what we want to achieve in a given financial year. It's our whole time. Recruitment and relocation, as you know, when vacancies do arise in an organization, we must plan, we must advertise positions. In some instances, we go to agencies because some of our staff members are very specialized. We're recruiting accountants, we're recruiting lawyers, we're recruiting actuaries. So we do not normally get that informal advertising process in the newspapers. So in that regard, we sometimes go to advertising agencies or employment agencies, and they do not come cheap. They would charge you a percentage of your annual salary. I'm sure some of you would know that. Registration and accreditation costs. The accreditation needs is involved in the registration of administration. So this is the work that we do. We costing that particular work. And we call it the registration and accreditation cost. They go out to visit administrators to see if they are properly accredited to do the work of administrators. The rental, we do not have our own building. We rent the building from where we operate, and the rent escalates at 7% per annum, and in May of each year. And the courtiers also, we went out on a tender to have our courtiers for purpose of our own operation. Research cost, I think we have a research unit which has been outlined by Patrick. That's what they are intending doing this financial year. And knowledge management is your information session where we disseminate information through electronic means. And our salaries are budgeted on a total cost to company. We do not have a pension fund. If we say to you your total package in a year is 600,000, that means you have to pay for your pension, you have to pay for your medical aid, and any other thing that is related to your well-being as an employee of the council. We do not have a pension in place, but I think that our salaries, that's how we approach that. Staff training, this is also a very important aspect. For purposes of doing our job, you need to develop yourself from time to time. And what we do in that operational session that I alluded to, people do identify courses that they will be undertaking in line with their work. In line, we do sponsor the staff training development in terms of, in relation to the work we do, so that when you are an accountant, you cannot tell us that you want to do a course in engineering, but we want you to do courses in line with your financial skills to promote your line of operation. Questionnaire is simple matter that ordinary, and strategic training session, each year we go to a booster rack with counselors just to discuss our strategic issues ranging from your legislative processes and whatever is relevant to the working of the council. Telephone and faxes, as you know, that will be your normal administrative expenses. Trustee training, that's also an important aspect of the work we do. Our education and training unit go out to talk to trustees of medical schemes, because we view them as very, very important stakeholders in terms of the operation of medical schemes, because they are the main people who are taking decisions in respect to the operations of the scheme. And water and electricity, you will also know that website development. This year we want to revamp our website, because I think since inception of council, that has never been looked into. And as you know, technology changes from time to time. This year we've put in an amount that will look into a website design. And we have advertised a tender in that regard. We are adjudicating over the tender. Thank you, Chair. Just to indicate that in terms of our procurement processes, Chair, we do go out on tender in terms of the mandate of the legislation, the KFNA, and all the relevant supply chain management regulations. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much, Katie and Natalie Khuta. This is going to be time for the members to ask you as many questions. It's at 11 o'clock now. Members, that's the presentation by the medical in council. I want to say medical aid. We are not medical aid, too. That is the presentation. It's time for you to engage them on what they have presented. There are some few points that I've jotted down here, but I think I'll be the last one to ask you questions. I wanted to relax. I see Ndate Hanari, I see Mike, I see the youth. Okay, I see Mr. Trete. I see Mother's wife. Okay, can go on that.
One at a time. Could I ask one for question?
I'm hoping that what you're going to be doing, you jot down what they are asking so that when we come to them, then we respond.
On the outside by the issue of solvency, about whether in terms of the your graph, do you include the bargaining council medical aid, or are they excluded? And whether I should be able to say from your figures, should I assume that the industry's gross profit was about 9.3 billion? And in terms of your report, to say that the gross income and the gross expenditure. The other one is the average period a person has to wait if the person lodges a complaint with you. And the last one is they said they have got about 300 people as to do consumer education. I would like to know how many people do they reach the annum, and what mechanism do they utilize to reach members of the different medical aid schemes.
Thank you very much.
I think we'll go according to that. But I just want to mention to the members, I think we are talking to the council. I'm not saying there's anything wrong, but we're talking to the council now. We're not talking directly to the medical aid.
Yeah,
we're talking to the council, which is doing another job, sort of oversighting the medical aid. Yeah, I'm right, okay.
Okay, can you go? No, I think you were not part of what you are going to come, man. I mentioned them as well.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the presenters for their input. I've got one question to do with the budget. The investigation costs and the legal fees only amount to about 6.3% of the total budget. I mean, is that enough to conduct your work as far as investigations are concerned? It seems a very small amount of the total budget. If if one of your main roles is to protect consumers and investigate their complaints. And as far as the first presentation was concerned, I've lost my space now. The Sunday Times had an article two Sundays ago about members running out of benefits well before the year ended. I mean, could you give us some insight into your investigations into that matter as to whether aid happening and to what degree, and did the article capture it properly, or was it underestimated or even overestimated? If you can just give us some idea of what is happening and what the reasons are, and what your negotiations have been with the medical aid companies on that ground. And you also talked about, when you said how many medical schemes there were bargaining council medical schemes. I didn't quite understand that. If you could talk about that a little bit. But if I heard you, if I understand vaguely, it's to do with low-income workers, is it? That can't afford medical aid cover. If that's the case, how do you envisage that all working families could actually access medical aid cover? Because currently it's beyond the reach of many families, given the high cost. So how would you see the expansion of membership of medical aid schemes? And then you also mentioned, last question, Chair, the new proposals, legislative proposals, the NHI in particular. And although no official document has been released yet, you're all in the dark, but there's been many articles in the paper and much spinning of the issue, if I can put it that way. Where do you see your role in the future with NHI? Thank you very much. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks. I think it's... the youth and then move to check.
Thanks, Chair. My question is, on your slide, there's a slide which says that the accounting structure, which is the accounting authority, here starts from the minister, then the council, and then the acting CEO or the CEO. So I want to
understand whether really do the minister account on this council, because let's say, because right now you are saying that you are having clean audits and everything is going smoothly. Should anything not go correctly and this portfolio committee request the accounting authority in the medical council, would we have to call you from the call the council from the minister or what? I don't know whether it is correct, but you'll clarify me. And then my second question is that the CFO mentioned that in terms of the internal audit within the council, you have outsourced that section, meaning when you have outsourced it, you are using consultants or a company that does internal audits on your part. Well, I want to know if that is fruitful expenditure in terms of, you know, as government, the president has mentioned that we want to do away with consultants, we want to hire personnel that will do the work, but consultants are costly than hiring personnel. And what is the total cost of the company that is doing the internal audit for the council? And then my third question is, you said that when you outsource, you hire staff skills through recruiting agencies. I want to find out whether when we talk about these recruiting agencies, are we talking about these labor brokers where you hire people through labor brokers and so on? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair. One is really appreciate, because for now, the person will be knowing whom to talk to when there is a complaint around me, because there are a lot of complaints. You have just made mention that you covered 24 conditions, 26, okay. And you make examples of this one. What we really want to know specifically is what are the most one which I want to know is interview included in all the colleagues. I just at your complaint, like I said that when I started that one is ready to have this opportunity to have this type of facility. How does an ordinary member know about you? Because like I will just give an example whereby I'm a member of Platinum Health. Then because my husband is working every month, but I'm staying 200 kilometers from the prescribed doctor. How can that ordinary person in Monate Divide somewhere in the Northwest, who is supposed to travel to Russia in the 200 kilometers for the prescribed doctor?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to tell the presenter for your presentation. But could I just get the meaning of ITT on the
International Partnership Program.
If you alluded to that, maybe, but I'm not sure what kind of
I did not cover every aspect of the budget line item, but I'm free to answer your question.
Just have an idea. No, later on, not now. Even if it's outside the meeting, so I don't want to waste your time. I'm a bit worried about, I always hear people complaining about investigations or complaints. How long do it take for you to investigate the case and make sure, how fast do you do that? Because people, you know, always sometimes complain about having, you know, answers immediately. Yes. And then last one, I think I'm covered by other members, but I'm a bit worried about you. Most of your budget, it goes to the rent. Yeah, when I look at the amount that you pay for rent, do you mean to rent for the rest of your...
I suppose you're not sure of your future, so. So, Manfred, I've seen your hand.
Yes, I will thank you very much for the enlightenment. Now, I will explain that approach. One, the use of, when you talk about using an agency, advertise for the special people like actuaries and so on. And you said it's very expensive. I just thought to myself, why?
Mamu Albert Lutul, can you sit on your gadget in front of you?
Okay. My gadget is in my gadget as well.
Yeah. You know, I just thought to myself, why can't you do it yourself? I mean, you do advertise. For the other short reason, yeah. Even though I understand that there's difference, but what's there? Maybe we don't understand what the difference is there, and we're concerned about the use of gas resources, money itself. And then a colleague here touched on the medical, this whole issue of medical aid running out. You know, it is extremely problematic. Are you looking at that at all? Is there a way of really dealing with, you know, this matter? Because it is extremely problematic that medical aid runs out anytime. You know, it could even be May, June, July, or something like that. And then patients really do suffer. Perhaps the doctors, you know, who deliver this. It's a serious, serious issue. And then, now, just on that too, it also means that some of these patients, of course, end up now being going back to the public sector, which then came the problem, you know, that has been supposed to be for the medical scheme. So it's something I think that we need to investigate and come up with some solutions. Now, there is the issue of, I'm sure doctors phone you all the time about medical aid not paying GP, you know, and then cash flow. It is extremely difficult to run a practice out there. It's a huge, huge problem. Now, I'll talk from personal experience myself. One time I even had to go to the what do you call this medical, you know, the where Bonitas and all those things are med scheme, yeah, administrator, yeah. She talked to them, what's going on? First, the managers won't see you if you're just a doctor, GP. There's no time for you. They won't see you. And I said, why? Because they say that they have no relation. They're not contracted. There's no contract between them and the doctor. The contract is between them and the patient. Now, I don't understand that, because the doctor is, after all, the one who's doing all the work and spending the money, you know, and making it possible. He's delivering. But at the end, there's no payment to, you know, to replenish
the doctor's bank account. So this to me is at the root of a lot of problems that we are then meeting, in health. Because then the doctors get fed up and leave for other areas of work and actually stop practicing as doctors and going to even other kinds of business and all that. I think that's a huge area that you need to, to sort out. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Maybe it's nice when they leave the private sector, they go to public hospitals.
They don't.
They don't go somewhere, they go to public hospitals.
They go
elsewhere. Can I tell you that, the always enemy of a person is the time.
Mm-hmm.
Would have liked to have a lot of time with you, but I'm requesting members, just if we can just do that. I know we're hearing this for the first time, but if we can just to the point so that we can have enough time to engage them more. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Can you switch off the one next thing?
One of the objectives of the one of the functions of the council is to control and coordinate the functioning of medical schemes in a manner that is complementary to the national health policy. There is a large debate now to say that private health care is actually detrimental to public health care in many ways, in flight of human resources, flight of capital, and the escalation costs and the increase in tax expenditure subsidy. Would you like to just say to us how is the council complying with its function in view of that? The second thing is that, the issue of the fair treatment campaign and the issue of complaints versus compliance and the campaign that we went on to get schemes to comply rather than to follow complaints. Would you like to just tell us about that? The third thing is that in the statutes of the Act, we have that all accounts must be paid within 30 days of delivery of submission of the accounts. How effective is that being done? Because if that is being done, the question of malutility becomes obsolete in what happens in that respect. But I'd really like you to follow on Mike's question to explain to this portfolio committee the magnitude of the investigation. I'd like you to use Discovery as an example, because you investigate for 980 million rands, and how much money you have to spend to get that money back, 980 million rands. And then if you're fighting giants like that, what a budget you would need to take this on, and so that one understands the effects of this. And that is why we're only touching the tip of the iceberg. And to give an overview of some of the mismanagement that has been uncovered till now, you've uncovered millions of rands of mismanagement. It's almost half a billion rands. And so, and if you had to pursue that function properly, what you would do?
Thank you, Terabile. I'm not sure, Honorable, so you wanted to ask something?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. I think we will have a second round, but we'll try and make it short because the time is totally against us. But if you could go on to this. But just to ask you when you're going to answer. In South Africa, we're dealing with an asymmetrical country. They are the very rich and the very poor. The unfortunate part is that the very poor don't seem to have any way of looking after their health, except for the public institutions that are there. Yet when they've got diseases, they affect even those that are rich. So I'm looking at medical aid, not necessarily you being pivotal in making sure that South Africa is healthy, in making sure that everybody is healthy. Maybe if you could enlighten us on that. I see here you put up a graph, and the graph shows us a bigger percentage goes to hospitals, private hospitals, and then followed by specialists. Probably I should have been in private practice and coining it from that money. But there's nothing that talks about how much money does it go to the public institutions. Because some of us, though we've got medical aid, but we do go to the public institutions and we've got medical aid. Do they ever claim from you, the public institutions? You can go on, you can go on and answer.
Thank you to
all of you for the questions. I'll give you them in the other news for what you have, but I noticed that I'm overloaded.
The first question had to do with solvency of bargaining counter. I think that the reason I mentioned this was to highlight the fact that, yes, there is a medical schemes environment which caters for a particular group, but there is another level that couldn't be brought into the medical schemes environment for affordability reasons. And recognition was taken of that by council to allow them to trade, if only within the broader parameters of labor stroke medical schemes act. So much so that when time comes and they arrive for the taking, they should then transfer into the medical schemes environment. The difficulty is that if you're paying 30 rand per member per month as part of the broader labor union bargaining council environment, to force that scheme into the medical schemes environment will be suicidal. But at the same time, you'll be depriving those people the whatever little access they have to private health, to healthcare. So that said, we don't necessarily take any information from them for that reason. But secondly, because their bargaining council, sometimes they don't have the kind of system that you have in the medical schemes environment. The auditing process sometimes takes 2 to 3 years. So that will confirm the picture. But in terms of membership, you're talking of, I think, just under 500,000 beneficiaries in those medical or bargaining council medical schemes. There was a question of solvency and profit. Solvency, perhaps from an accounting perspective, it can be construed as profit, but from a medical scheme perspective, you don't see it as profit, but it's part of the output of members, because in any case, medical schemes are owned by members. So where you've got that 9 billion or whatever, we derive a lot of comfort from the fact that if something were to go wrong with that medical scheme, the medical scheme can, at the very least, withstand for a period of time the vagaries of life honoring the claims of its members. Some schemes would ordinarily chip into that to subsidize contributions. And instead of, for example, 14% contribution increase, some schemes might charge a lot less comparatively speaking. But it's a situation we monitor from time to time. And like I said, not all of them are currently meeting that requirement. We've got, I think, close on 18 open medical schemes that are safe to meet with the prescribed level of solvency. And among those 18, some are on the deathbed. We call them ICU schemes. So much so that the least we can do under those circumstances is to encourage them to either amalgamate at best or liquidate at worst. So there are those situations. In terms of resolution of complaints, the law prescribes a 30-day turnaround time, and we try to stick to that. And I'll explain why the slight caveat, which is not necessarily enshrined in the legislation, that we normally pursue. In instances where someone is an oxygen and it's a matter of life and death, you cannot wait for 30 days. So ordinarily, we'll try to expedite the process, engage with the medical team, and try to see what the issues are and what interventions can be brought about. But for all other complaints, they follow a 30-day turnaround time. However, you do come across odd instances where a medical team on the 29th day might come back and say, can I have a bit more time to look at this issue? So on that score, we will look at the merits of the situation, and if indeed there are justifiable reasons, we might grant that. But as long as that will obviously be against the extent of the prejudice to the member, that might follow as a result of the delay in response to that instruction. There was the issue of adequacy of budget. We wish we could get more, not only for investigation and legal issues, but just for our general operations. We are a staff of 78. We only have got one office in Pretoria. We service all those stakeholders, including 7.8 million people. It does present its own challenges, but we have had to make do with the resources that we've got, mindful of the fact that we derive our revenue from levies, and you can't put too much pressure on members through levies. We do prioritize our investigations most of the time. We pick our battles nicely, if you like. And in many instances, we also put in a clause, if it's a court-driven investigation, we put a provision of clawback to say the medical team has to pay us that whatever we spend in the investigation. But when necessary, penalties might also be imposed in those medical teams, because most of them, or at least the trustees, might also have insurance cover or indemnity cover or something like that. But it is an area that we constantly review, and it can, in some instances, be a limiting factor. Benefits running out, what is happening. We, in the medical system environment, we've got two types of benefits. You've got your legislated benefits. Those are your prescribed minimum benefits. And by law, those should never run out. They are limited only by the protocol. I think it can be a challenge sometimes, because we say the protocols of the Department of Health. If you can't find the National Department of Health, check the protocols of the province. If you can't find those of the province, check those of the tertiary institution. It's all in the act. But technology has improved, and it does present challenges sometimes when you adjudicate on some of these issues. But TMB on their own should never run out, at least for commensurate with the condition in question and guided by those protocols. The second component is the enhanced benefits. These are the add-ons that medical teams will provide, primarily for out-of-hospital cover. And I think that is where we face major challenges. There has been a lot of innovation in the environment. We all now know that the medical service account is the in thing. It takes about a maximum of 25% of your contribution. And when you think of it, that 25% is money that is being taken out of what should be in the risk pool. So the individualized portion will be 25%. And depending on what level you are at, if you're in the low option where you're paying 400 cents, 25% of that 400 cents will obviously be a very negligible amount. You also have instances where medical teams in enhanced benefits will have what we call deductibles, thresholds, etc. That is where we continue to have problems with some things, because some deductibles are taxed so high it has to be prohibitive for access to health care. Some self-payment gaps are not reflective of the socioeconomic status that we operate in. And it is those particular instances that we investigate all the time. We try to engage with the scheme and try to bring some sanity to the process, because you have to look at it ultimately from the quality of care that a member will derive from that particular contribution arrangement. I indicated that we'll be investigating non-PMD and the adequacy thereof, or the impact on members. It is something that we're aware of, and it is something that we will be pursuing in any. There was the issue of bargaining council and how we can get working families into the environment. Currently, bargaining council are not regulated as tightly as the medical teams would. In fact, we have left it to the labor department to monitor how the processes unfold. But we do interact with them. We did a research about 3-4 years ago where we were trying to find out at what stage of development they were at. and we found that some were still at the same level at which they were. And I would imagine things would have gotten worse now with the economic situation. How we can get them on board? There was an attempt courtesy of the project by the Department of Health to look at the low end of the market. So the full-fledged investigation reports were put together. And in the medical schemes amendment bill, there was an inclusion of an enabling provision to allow for the emergence of the low-income medical schemes. Needless to say, that has been overtaken by events, and we will be guided by how the NHS process unfolds. It could very well be that that process might find a home there. I don't know, and I don't even want to preempt the outcome of this. What is our role in the NHR? Simply, I'll speak a positive one. We have always been participating in the healthcare reform process. Those who have interacted with us will appreciate the fact that the initial trajectory was through the SHI and then the NHI. So this just has to shortcut that process, and one will obviously await clarity on what the proposals are, what the product is, etc., before we make a final determination on how cancer can participate in the process. But from a slightly different angle, there is a lot of expertise that is accrued within cancer in terms of a range of activities that pertain to the health insurance environment. And one would imagine that expertise wouldn't just be thrown away, but might be brought to bear in some way into the process on finishing. There will be, I presume, a need to do intensive technical assessment, and we see ourselves playing a part in that regard. But the details will be dependent on the final product that will be made. There was a question on accountability structure. I think when I said accountability structure, it's more a reporting structure. The council is an independent entity classified under Schedule 3. The accounting officer is the CEO. The oversight structure is the council, but ultimately we report to the department as one of the many councils within the department. You've got the MRC, you've got the Health Professional Council. So that's their relationship. But much more than that, it makes sense for us to insist reporting in that manner, as opposed to perhaps some of the other proposals that were made to say report to traders, because this is about health policy. And I think that health policy development needs to take into account tools for implementation, one of which in this case, or currently, is the Medical Schemes Act, or the Council for Medical Schemes. There were concerns raised around internal outsourcing of internal auditing. The council is a very small organization, 78 odd people, highly specialized in that regard. And we felt comfortable in outsourcing this activity as we ordinarily would for legal issues. Our legal issues, legal unit is very small, we've got two people. So ordinarily, they'll do the harvesting of the issue and then pass it off. But on this one, we also feel it's important because it brings a level of independence by someone who's not attached to the issue to sort of objectively look at us and judge us on the basis of how we're performing rather than on the fact that they like my face. So it brings some objectivity there. Third skill, we don't use labor brokers. We never have, and I don't think we ever will. What we do here is to source specific expertise through agents. What they'll do is to identify, it's headhunting, basically, that we require them for. It's very difficult to get an actuary to work for the Council for Medical Schemes. They command leaders in the environment. But we were happy that for once in the life of council, we were able to attract an actuary
will be dealing with contributions and benefits and assurance determining the appropriateness of what will be submitted to council. So to us it was a major victory, and one which we couldn't have done through others. We did advertise in the City Press, Sunday Times, and any other possible media you can think of. We weren't successful. Chronic conditions, you wanted a list. I don't know if I should read it out. I can make copies if that is okay. But it covers quite a range.
I think the specific question is those conditions that are not covered there, why are they not part of that? I think that's where the question goes.
Okay.
But you don't have to answer it now.
No. When chronic conditions are developed, it was back in 2003. There was wide consultation around the issue. There was a huge list of proposed chronic conditions, which included depression, etc. And when they were put to test looking at cost effectiveness, affordability, etc., the response that the department posited, we participated in a department process, was that for starters, these benefits will be fine. Whereafter, they'll be subjected to the same kind of setup as PMDs are, to say over time, what are the implications on the scheme, what's the value proposition on members, etc. So ordinarily, they were supposed to be reduced every 2 years. We have done that, but the process was stalled because of the current development. So we've got protocols that take into account improvements in technology in terms of treatment of those conditions. But that process obviously was overtaken by then. We would have liked to include biologicals, which is a big issue. But we obviously have to be guided by the studies on how the process will unfold. The second one was HIV. HIV is included in the DTC because it's not only a chronic condition, but it's got other dimensions. So the entire national policy on AIDS treatment of HIV is included as part of the treatment protocol for HIV. However, we have seen some things adding more than what is required, because what we have here is a minimum that a scheme is required to provide. You alluded to 100 kilometers. I would imagine it's got more to do with the designation of service provider than the first thing. We wouldn't approve any singles where access to healthcare by virtue of availability of service or accessibility is 200 kilometers or more. We are guided by the WHO standard. So in instances where a scheme designates a provider that is out of town, a member, in terms of the law, can access the service close by on an involuntary basis. Because ideally what we interpret this as is that you would have wanted to go to that service, but because it's far, you rather go to the service that is close by, because it's amenable to access to health. You will incur more expenses or other contributions to travel to 200 kilometers, but it's also not amenable to access to health. So any scheme that has got that will be discarded. And if I were to be a bit more specific, we did engage with Platinum Health Group. They used to have this, they don't have it anymore. You can look at the two options that they've got. If they still do, please bring it to our attention. It might be a misdemeanor on the part of the scheme, and we will have to deal with them within the context of the law. There was a question on the time to investigate. I think it's medical scheme. This is dependent on the extent of the investigation. The one that is now in the public domain would take 3 months because it's a big investigation. Others will take 2 days, and the time will vary. In terms of complaints, I think I've covered this before. And on the rental, do I have to report to that?
I think, Patrick, what you should do is to, as a follow-up, just the secretary, send complaints procedure, because all people here are representatives of communities. So there's a complaint procedure and the 30 days limit, how it works, whom to contact, how you get a number, what you follow it up with. Maybe you should send that to the secretary so that is distributed to all members for them to do.
I talked about the reason why I'm asking this. In most cases, if someone came from renting, and if you look at the rental, May here is 185, and then April is 185, and May is 1.26. I don't know what it means. That's why I'm asking
the question. It won't also reflect expansion because we're doing incrementally taking space within the
yeah. But I think more specifically our rented salary was in May. Yeah. But in terms of that particular question, yes. The Act provides that we can acquire a movable property or whatever the case may be. It depends on how we can go about that. And I think the Chair has alluded to a very painful reality that our future is also dependent on what's happening in the NHI. We do not know. We cannot just go out now and acquire our own building when we do not know how long or what role we will play ultimately in terms of the broader policy objective.
But we must know the question. Future is very neutral.
The future.
But your future depends on what? On the past.
Yes.
So if it depends on the past and today. So if your today in the past is positive, your future will be positive. So don't be worried. That's the positive, but things are not
worried. Thank you. That's assuring.
Oh, okay, KP. You can close your thing, KP.
Okay,
thanks. I think the issue of benefits running out that has been. Agency, I think I've covered that. On the issue of use of public sector, what you see there is expenditure on the private sector. And the question was, to what degree do things use the public sector? They do use the public sector. In at the end of 2008, they were paid a total of 225 million. However, that is minuscule when you look at the broader, at the overall amount paid to hospitals, because it constitutes less than 1% of the total expenditure on hospitals, and it has gone down by 37%. The year before, it was 2%, and we had hoped it would increase. We don't know what the reasons are. We can only speculate as to the challenges thereof. But we would have wanted the private sector to benefit from provision of healthcare to members. In that, the spin-off of that would have been a moderation of contributions, because all the contributions or all the benefits that we saw there are accessed primarily in the private sector. And with all the challenges that are happening, the legal suits, et cetera, it doesn't help the situation but exacerbates it, but there is provision to do that. There are provinces such as the Eastern Cape, which had what is called a DSPN, Designated Service Provider Network, where the intention was to begin to provide infrastructure where the public sector can contract with medical teams to provide services through that avenue. I cannot attest to the fate of that process.
Can we leave it to finish unless it's something that you think we need
to do? Related to this, Chairperson.
The problem is that we're going to have questions again. Just write it down. And then we're going to ask questions again.
The issue of unpaid accounts, I am aware that it's a serious problem. There are all sorts of explanations and counter-explanations that are advanced. But our position has always been that in terms of Section 59, if a member accesses services, the scheme cannot turn around and say, I can't pay you directly. You know, they can pay that provider directly. In fact, the majority of schemes do that. It's only those that want to wiggle out of the situation that will do that. But we are mindful of the fact that it's judicial to provide us. So we would have thought that sanity will prevail
in those medical teams that do that, and at the very least try to compensate that provider for what is due to them. In instances where there are challenges, we do entertain complaints from the providers, and we try to adjudicate on those. I think the other dimension of the debate around the code, with now as we can code in the environment, and some providers sometimes, not all, sometimes would send through non-discrete codes and demand payment for PMD conditions. And that cannot be, because it's only a PMD on the basis of the diagnosis. And if your diagnosis is non-discrete, we wouldn't encourage the team to do that. In fact, if a team does that, they'll be violating the law. But there are many reasons, and it's something that perhaps we need to delve deeper and try to understand what's happening. Incidentally, about 2 years ago, we did a full-fledged investigation in the environment where we got DHS, my colleague will remember that, to look at how to deal with Section 59, which deals with payments for providers. We did get responses from DHS, but we're still awaiting responses from providers. There was ASA representative bodies like SAMA, etc., that participated. Yeah, the full day was shut. But I'm not saying that what is happening is correct. We will carry on, despite not having had input from those who we thought would have to start in developing an appropriate intervention to deal with that concern. Yeah. There were questions around complementarity to health. I think when one looks at the situation from the time when council was formed till today, I think there has been an attempt made to ensure that at the very least there's complementarity with it. I think the challenge we face is that to really hammer it down, you also need other factors to be brought about, like the provider work. We don't have any control on what the doctor charges, but we know that given the current environment, the Health Professions Council provision, they can charge as much as 300% or 400%. In fact, some of them will tell us in our face today, I'm entitled to this. And the challenge in South Africa is that when you've got a GP who's operating in Soweto, he can't subscribe to that because they've got the localized community rate of course, where those who grew up in those environments will know that going to a GP, you charge your fresh rate, you get your medicine, etc. Mm-hmm. And we have been approached by those constituents to say, look, it is a nice thing to be paid for those amounts. However, we are mindful of the environment in which we operate, and we prefer to restrict ourselves to that, which we think will broaden access to healthcare. But of course, you have to deal with it in broader context. It's the reality that we are living in. And that is why there was a proposal to look at the so-called bargaining council for deliberation around the pricing in the healthcare environment. I know that the department attempted to put the National Health Act amendment, which was supposed to speak to that, but you know, there were challenges and it was subsequently withdrawn. We still feel the bargaining council approach will be the one that is a bit more amenable to the realities of the situation that we find ourselves in. Mm-hmm. But that is the prerogative of the department and certainly not the council. Complaints versus compliance. Our approach has always been that where, in fact, the way it works is that we monitor complaints on a regular basis by type as well as by in. And the reason for that is twofold. One, we want to understand how the act is unfolding in the environment. Two, we want to understand whether the complaints that we're receiving are as a consequence of operational difficulties. So some of those complaints might reflect challenges in the legislation. Other times, challenges in the operation. So when we analyze them, we look at those factors. Where it's got to do with
challenges in the legislation, we will make appropriate representations to the Department for Legislative Amendments, which is why the CONIC issue came about, or how the CONIC issue came about. Where it got to do with operations, we will engage with the respective medical schools to try to remedy the situation. But we flag it for accreditation, because all administrators are accredited. And if they continue to present the challenges, obviously it threatens their accreditation status, and that can be withdrawn. We haven't done it yet, except for one scheme, that one administrator that engaged the family, the case of which is in court at the moment. So that's how we deal with the two. But in terms of compliance, our compliance is much wider, because it complies with the entire legislation. And right now our focus has been on non-healthcare expenditure, where we're trying to get medical schemes to moderate instances where non-healthcare expenditure tends to be exaggerated. The accounts, I think I've covered that. Investigations and time budget. It is a costly exercise, especially when you're getting an external person. And this ordinary will be court-initiated investigations where we foresee opposition by the parties concerned. Because the unfortunate reality today is that when you challenge Board of Trustees, they would obviously use the coffers of the scheme to defend that position, and it becomes a very difficult situation. So sometimes where we foresee that eventuality, we would go the whole hog and approach the High Court. It's not cheap, but our race really is to ensure that at the end of the day, members get value for the heart and mind that they are trained to be constructive. And that is precisely the reason why we approach the court for volunteers, because we could see the stakes were high, a lot of memberships that are exposed in that scheme, and we wouldn't want anything to go wrong. But for all other smaller schemes, we'll do our investigations within the parameters of the law. We've got enabling legislation to investigate, and we would decide that using our own staff. You spoke about mismanagement.
I just wanted you to explain about the magnitude of the investigations that we do and the amount of money that we're looking at. I mean, if you look at the investigation we did against Discovery, it was about 490 million. And what a long battle of 2 years it took, and how much does it cost to get that money back. And how schemes also use the process where when the council makes a decision in favor of a member, they just start appealing it because they know that the member does not have the money to fight the cases back, and what the council does to assist them. But the magnitude of the investigations, I mean, if you look at the issue of MAP, how much money we are talking about, if you look at Discovery, how much money, if you look at Bonitas, we're talking about 50 million and things like that. When you start to investigate these kind of figures, you really need muscle power behind you, otherwise you're fighting, you know, with the air gun against somebody who's got an AK-47 and everything. No, thanks for the clarification. Okay. I think it's unfortunate that you do come across those situations, because ordinarily you would have wanted Board of Trustees to act in the best interest of the member. But like all other things in life, the lot of money that flows between schemes, the smallest scheme commands not less than 100 million, and you do see this eventuality. Throughout the life of council, we have investigated those issues, Discovery, Bonitas, Gen Health, etc. And like I said, we sometimes will be able to claw back that money. In other instances, you just have to look at it for example. Recently, in fact, as recent as last year, we were able to get the asset forfeiture unit to attach assets of a scheme called Gen Health, where again we were investigating Ms. Nina. The assets were to the value of 47 million, and we are comfortable that the intervention that was executed and the money that was spent were worth every penny in the pursuit of protection of members.
But yes, it does take time. It does take a lot of money. We also find it unfortunate where scheme, when a member complains and we rule in favor of the member, the scheme for some bizarre reason would appeal. And where it gets unfortunate is when they lose not only the appeal but also the appeal board ruling, because it then suggests that this scheme was not acting in the best interest of members but perhaps against the member. Because schemes have got several mechanisms they can use to mitigate risk. But schemes also have what we call ex gratia, which are exceptions that they grant members. So sometimes the arguments are that if we grant an entitlement to this member, it will lead to wholesale a demand by members. And I don't buy that argument. I think it's a very unproductive kind of argument. It then doesn't take into account the interests of members, and it discounts members' entitlement because all ex gratia are done on their own merits. They're evaluated, look at the cost benefit, the value proposition, and you make a determination. We are not saying they should give wholesale ex gratia, but they need to look at whether the likelihood of success would be achieved. And if that is the case, then that's great. We've got a situation like that with one scheme where they refuse to provide a member physiotherapy, and I don't think physiotherapy can break a bank. But that scheme went so far as changing the rules just to exclude that member. Unfortunately, they lost the case at the appeals board, where you need to pay a lot of money, you need to call lawyers, and we are looking at those issues. I think the last issue was how do we make South Africa healthy?
Maybe we can leave it for later. Let's give them another.
If time is just for work now, we still have another thing that we have got to do after this. So we'll have to, unfortunately, we'll have to give a few hands to ask questions. You wanted to ask Dr. Sile, and I see Uma Mukenya. Those will be the two last questions. Okay.
Chairperson, the question that was put was that how much money that is coming from private medical aid can go to the public sector in the public sector hospitals? As the CEO, acting CEO, correctly pointed out, in some provinces and in some places we were proactive in that we signed DSP agreements. DSP is a designated service provider agreement, which means we are guaranteed payment.
Sorry, Siva, are you answering for them or are you asking them a question? Which one are you? No, I'm just asking.
I'm asking a question, sir.
You're asking a question, okay.
Well, I'll forget it.
No.
Okay.
No.
Fine.
No, I was asking whether you are asking a question or you're answering for them.
The person we established in the start, I'm asking a question.
Continue.
No, it's okay, sir.
Okay, come with him.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is on the vision of CNS. As you just said, that this vision is to regulate trade and effectively, what mechanisms, therefore, are in place to bridge the gap between the rich and the poor? If you say you want to promote equity and access to equity to schemes and protect citizens, and also to avoid discrimination as a constitution and also as a nature to the NHI. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think those were the last questions. Maybe, I didn't ask you, is there any other question that is pending? Last question. You can switch off my thing.
Okay.
Maybe this question goes hand in hand with what you said. You said when you started, your trajectory was social health insurance. And now things seem to be changing towards national health insurance. Now the question that comes up is, what has been your experience in that trajectory? What is your experience that you can put into the new sort of policy direction which is not yet there. I'm not sure whether this is clear.
Yeah. No, I get the question. I think the difficulty for me is that some of the projects that we are currently working on were still in line with that trajectory, but we acknowledge that the cost has changed, and we would engage with the Department of Health. We have been engaging with them to seek clarity on how the initial process would unfold. We have refrained from engaging with the process on a speculative basis, which is why till now Council has not made a formal pronouncement on the NHI, because we have tried several times to request a presentation by Council. Our chairperson requested that, and we haven't been successful. Even now we tried, but we haven't. But we were promised that in the next Council meeting in November, during that strategic meeting, there will be better clarity, because the letter to Cabinet will have been finalized, the document will have been published, and we're hoping that that will give us an opportunity to formally engage with the process.
Okay, then we can come to the second.
I think our vision was premised on several factors. Because when the legislation was promulgated, it was never the intention of the legislature to have medical schemes providing these benefits wholly or solely in the private sector. At that stage, there was noble intentions that the public sector would be reinvigorated, revitalized, and in sync with that, the PMB package won't be interfered with, you know, etc. Unfortunately, that didn't unfold the way it did, and we found ourselves in this environment. And there have been several interventions, the Competition Commission intervention, which meant that providers can no longer come together to arrange prices. DHF was also affected in the pronouncement. So the long and short of it is that we can do as much as we can on the funding side of the environment, but we don't have any control on the delivery side of the environment. We can't tell doctors how much to charge and, you know, to what degree they should do that. And it becomes a serious risk for medical care, because they will price products. And these are complex products to price, because not only do you price services, but diagnosis and sometimes technology. To then price it at a particular level and charge it at that, and find that the provider wants a bit more. So the effect of that is something that we cannot control. We have tried to get involved with the process when we're still responsible for the national reference prices, but we've now moved to the department, and that is where we're trying to participate. But like I said, we would have preferred something like a bargaining council, because that will then ensure that all the parties contribute to the process, but there's better certainty on the pricing of those products, so much so that we can then adjudicate on whether that the price is fair, the same way that perhaps one would do a loaf of bread to say is a kilogram commensurate with the price. So currently, we are faced with that unfortunate situation. We are trying our best to regulate failure. There was a process on treatment of beneficiaries. We look at marketing materials. We do investigations. We look at the financial situation of schemes. But that is as far as the council can go within its mandate. Yes.
You can go to that last one. We're giving you about 5 minutes. That last one about
your healthy. How do we make healthy? I think it's sort of is similar to what has been proposed, but I think the slight difference here is that the PMB review process was done to ensure that we're able to identify gaps of what would constitute essential healthcare cover for a medical scheme member and a South African consumer. And that process has been able to do just that, because there was talk around appending
the primary care benefits, which currently are not incorporated. And when you look at the Medical Things Act, for example, the amendment bill, it talks about basic package. So those were interventions that were construed as being appropriate to complete a member's entitlement in the medical things environment. Currently, I cannot say much because I think everything will be dependent on how the NHI process unfolds and whether or not all the process that the council is involved in at the moment are still relevant. Because if they aren't, we need to take that decision so that we do going forward. But I would imagine things like universal cover, essential health cover, would find their way through to this process. So that's the only way we can cover people broadly, obviously, perhaps with some rationing, and we will participate in that process with a view to ensuring that in South Africa does indeed remain healthy. There are a lot of health reform processes currently going on around the world. We've got examples from countries as far as China. Locally, we've got Ghana that has done certain things. We've got Europe. So those are models that one would want to, and Canada, of course, which is often mentioned. Those are models that ordinarily one would want to look at and take the lessons learned and ensure that the whole notion of this two worlds in one, two economies in one, the equitable distribution of resources is addressed and addressed sufficiently to obviate the need for this kind of ongoing problems where we focus perhaps sometimes on diseases of lifestyle to the detriment of infectious diseases that still afflict a great number of people. So one would need to strike a balance of how do you accommodate epidemiological transmission in this environment? How do we ensure that the social benefit is amplified in the current, in the new environment? How do we ensure that people who are currently facing situations where they have their houses attached because they can't pay their medical bills don't face that situation again? So there's a myriad of options that can be brought in the process, and I'm hoping that once the process commences, that there will be effective and positive engagement that is realized in a way that will set value and answer your question on how do we make South Africa healthy.
Thanks very much, Katie. Thank you very much for the answers that you've given us. I think we'll come to the end of that time. But as we have said at the beginning, that we're calling you as the counsel for medical aid. We know the medical aid themselves need to come here too, but we're going to find a process of how do we bring them here. Probably you will need one of you to be here when they are here so that we can ask. And I know some of the things that you're answering, especially on the future policies of government, you are not talking on their behalf. You are just talking the truth. How you see it yourself, not them. They will answer for themselves as to how they see the situation. So thank you very much, and if there's anything, we'll keep in contact, but we wanted to know how you're working. If those that did not ask questions, that did not answer, we know that you know what you know. So thank you very much, even for not talking. Thank you very much. Okay, we can have tea while they're moving out, and then we'll sit for our meeting panel.
Why do you take that?